Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Greetings, I'm Tricia Keffer from sunny Key Largo, Florida, your host for New Books in Architecture, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. If you have any ideas for books, please send me an email at plantspeoplelove@gmail.com. Today, our interview is with Ian Ray, and the book is No Little Plans, How Government Built America's Wealth and Infrastructure, published by Routledge in 2019. Today's guest is Ian Ray, and the book is No Little Plans, How Government Built America's Wealth and Infrastructure, published by Routledge in 2019. Hi, Ian. Welcome to the show.
Hello. Good to be here.
Well, thank you so much. And we've built up quite an audience on this category. I just want to let them know that we're enjoying a cup of tea transcontinental here this morning. From the Keys to London or to merry old England.
Yeah, cups of tea across the Atlantic, yeah.
A cup of tea across the Atlantic, exactly. Ian, thank you for being here. And can you tell the audience a little bit about yourself?
Yeah, sure. I'm a town planner and I was in professional practice until 2010, full-time, when I left to join Liverpool University as a visiting professor. I worked in the 1980s as a freelance journalist, mainly writing for the Architects Journal in London. So I've written a lot, vast numbers of articles and papers. And I write more like a journalist, perhaps, than an academic. I write to engage people as well as educate them. And I've written two or three books, edited a couple of books. The American Plans book is my most recent book. Prior to that, I wrote a book on Great British Plans, who made them and how they worked. So really, the American book is a sequel to the English book. And it's... Like the book on British plans, it's inspired really by the same author, my friend Professor Sir Peter Hall, who died a couple of years ago, brilliant planning academic. He wrote a book called Great Planning Disasters, which put very unsuccessful big plans under the microscope and asked what went wrong. And the purpose of both my books, both the British one and the American ones, is to put very successful plans under the microscope and ask, how do we do that?
How do it? So what was your motivation for writing this particular book?
Well, it was partly because when I'd been working as a professional planner, I'd found the system getting more and more complex and full of complex regulations and procedures and processes. And I, in the last few years as a professional planner, working professional planner, I just thought, you know, how on earth do we ever get things done? The system seems so complex and so opaque these days. So I was intrigued by the fact that planning academics didn't actually seem to have written all that much about plans that had gone well. Academics seem to love problems and things that have gone badly, but As a whole, as a generality, they don't really seem to have specialised in putting success under the microscope and saying, well, you know, how did we actually do that? I don't know why that is. Some academics, particularly people in business schools are interested in success stories, but my perception, maybe it's mistaken, is that that's much less true of other planning academics, including planning academics. So I wanted to have a look at success and see how it worked.
Oh, I love that. Yeah, how we what we did right is important to copy too.
It certainly is, yeah, yeah. So I wanted to know how things had actually gone well in the past. And it started out, in fact, both books started out as purely empirical inquiries. I just selected what seemed a wide range of variety of plans that had gone well, and I asked how it had happened. But as both books developed, but particularly the American book, I began to see that I was assembling all this empirical information on plans that had gone well, you know, going back as far as the first national parks and building the transcontinental railroads and taking the story right the way forward to almost the 21st century with the moonshot and the internet. And I began to see that this empirical evidence was actually starting to form a body of evidence that you could use to challenge the rather overweening ideology we've been labouring under since the 1970s, the sort of laissez-faire neoliberalism, the Milton Friedman stuff about companies only have to take their shareholders' interests in account and government is so weak that it's worse than ineffective, all summed up in that phrase of Ronald Reagan's, the 10 scariest words in the English language are, "Hello, I'm from government and I'm here to help."
Oh, yeah. Well, I think that that's a very good point, is that, you know, there's a lot of great and interesting achievements that our government has done. And I really like that we have, you know, an outsider's perspective, because it's hard to be objective when you're kind of in it.
Yes, absolutely.
So yeah, this is interesting. So what did we do right? How did you divide this book into three sections? Why is that? How's it laid out?
Well, it's laid out, yeah, as you say, in three sections. The first section is called American Retreat. And that really talks about the rise and fall of rational planning in America. It talks about the rational planning techniques, which were really first brought into American society and later into world society by people like Sloan in General Motors in the 1920s and 1930s, then hugely built on by a whole variety of management experts, and developed in particular by Robert Strange McNamara, to give him his full title. He was an absolutely brilliant businessman, developed these techniques largely during the Second World War, took them into the Ford motor industry, and became a brilliant strategist and operator, and was recruited by President Kennedy to move into government, became Secretary of State for Defense. So he took with him this huge body of rational planning techniques, which in the 1960s spread all over the world, in fact, and moved into industry, commerce, city planning, even subjects like geography, which is looking to produce give a new face to the world, a quantitative face to the world. And those techniques, of course, underlay the what the French call les trente glorieuses, the glorious 30 years after the Second World War, where Western society seemed to be on a continuously upward path, but were really brought down in the late 1960s and 70s, and they were brought down with a kind of pincer attack, if you like, from the right wing through people like Hayek, Friedman, Thatcher, Ronald Reagan, Milton Friedman, so from the right-wing economists who were attacking the notion that we could have effective rational planning, but at the same time, in a rather sort of a bizarre coincidence of odd bedfellows, if that's the right phrase to use, they were attacked by people on the left wing, including Jane Jacobs, whose philosophy was basically libertarian, actually, rather than socialist, and also, of course, by Rachel Carson in Silent Spring, who attack the whole basis of rational, planned industrial society. So after that great 30-year run, it all came crashing down in kind of around about 1968. So that's the first part of the book, really, that story about how it all came falling down and what the consequences then were for American society, before I move into the next part of the book, which is it's kind of like a roller coaster ride. The next part of the book, looking at the case studies, is a kind of upbeat look at the great success stories.
And you've got, let's see, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 categories of lots of case studies of good things. You know, in particular, since this is kind of the architecture, and I got my master's degree in landscape architecture, let's start with what about the national parks? How has that benefited the United States? How is that a success story?
Well, it's an amazing success story. And, you know, I had 3 years taught as a geographer and then 2 years as a planner. I even did a course on North America. I can't remember anybody teaching me how the national parks came into existence, but you know, the national park story, which has spread across the world, was an American invention. It's a great American plan, an example of great American planning. It came philosophically from David Thoreau, the author of Walden or Life in the Woods back in the 19th century. It came from the transcendental philosophers like Ralph Waldo Emerson, who taught Americans basically to value nature and wildlife just as they valued money. And it came from the great Scot, John Muir, who moved to America when he was a boy and became a huge environmental campaigner for the preservation of wildlife, national parks, and the great outdoors. And it was really because of Muir's campaigning in the late 19th century and then the relationship he formed with President Theodore Roosevelt, who was the greatest conservationist president America's ever had, without a doubt. I mean, there have been others, including his successor of the same name. I'm not quite sure whether your current president quite shares their objectives, but there have been great conservationist presidents. Jimmy Carter was another great conservationist president, so obsessed with wild rivers that apparently some people thought he was absolutely cookie. But the whole concept of having national parks and looking after nature is simply a great American success story. But it's a story, really, that was driven by government, by the American government, when Theodore Roosevelt said, yeah, we're going to do this.
Well, that's true. And, you know, our national parks, like here in the Keys, we have some John Benny Camp and Dighty Johnson parks here. And there are so many people that visit them, and they have to almost have traffic control. And what that also brings for the community, it's a lot of businesses are thriving just because they're right beside the national state parks.
Yes, that's absolutely true. I mean, the visits to national parks have absolutely rocketed over the last 3 or 4 decades. So on the one hand, yeah, sure, it's a success story, but it's a success story which needs to be very, very carefully managed. Sometimes the management has not been what it should have been. I mean, the critics say there has been far too much emphasis placed on recreation and pulling the visitor numbers in, which is President Trump's view that we ought to carry on just using them really as commercial assets. Others would say they've not done enough to protect the natural environment. But really, that's just about the details of how these places are managed. And it doesn't really detract from the huge success in creating them and protecting them. I mean, I've been to Niagara Falls. I don't know, have you been to Niagara Falls? Niagara Falls, wonderful natural asset, but was not protected by any kind of national park institution. And in many ways, the kind of the natural wonder of Niagara Falls has been destroyed by inappropriate development far too close to it, giving everybody a view from their hotel bedroom window of the majesty of the falls, but unfortunately spoiling the majesty for everybody else. You can still stand there and get wet under the falls, so that still works. But you don't have this feeling of being out in nature, out in the raw, out in the cold, out in the wild. And that's what the national parks have preserved, basically.
Well, that's true. No, I haven't been there. It's on my bucket list. But but I would be, it would be bad if I didn't mention, you know, the Everglades is right next door. It just going out there and walking through the woods and all its, and its value is just, I don't know. You can't really put a price tag on it.
No, there's a, there's an absolutely, absolutely wonderful quote, which I'm trying to find now, from Ralph Waldo Emerson, from his book called Nature, which was published in the 1890s. And this is a terrific quote. He says, crossing a bare common in snow puddles at twilight under a clouded sky, without having in my thoughts any occurrence of special good fortune, I have enjoyed a perfect exhilaration. I am glad to the brink of fear. In the woods, too, a man casts off his years as the snake his slough. And at whatsoever period of life is always a child. In the woods is perpetual youth. So that's a brilliant piece of writing, but also incredibly persuasive piece of philosophy that makes people value nature for what it is, basically.
Oh, yeah. Oh, I love that. Yeah, I
so
love
go read
those,
that book, Ralph Waldo Emerson, Nature.
I will. I think I have it actually here somewhere. It's too bad I can't interview him.
That would be an interesting interview.
That would be a good interview. Okay, let's go on to the wood. This is something I'm kind of interested to. My brother lived in Vegas, and I've been to the Hoover Dam. So what do you think about, you mentioned here, deals and dams. What is that all about?
Well, that's another another example of great American plans. If only by virtue of the sheer scale of the operation, and it's something that not a whole lot of people know about. Basically, the view taken, and again, this goes back to Theodore Roosevelt, who was a conservationist, but a kind of utilitarian conservationist. He didn't really believe in nature for its own sake. He believed in managed nature for the good of humanity. Theodore Roosevelt became really attached to the views which were being expressed by a lot of people in the late 19th and early 20th century, that if there was more effective irrigation of the American West, it would turn the American West into, rather than a kind of semi-desert environment, which so much of it is, apart from the immediate coastal strip, it would turn the American West into a huge orchard, a huge opportunity for growing fruit and vegetables. So it was Roosevelt who set the ball rolling by creating the American Bureau, Land Reclamation Bureau, to start building dams and to irrigate the far west. And that is a process that continued all the way through the 20s, the 30s, the 40s, the 50s. And of course, the Bureau is still in existence and has built hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of dams and hundreds of miles, if not thousands of miles, of irrigation infrastructure, particularly in the American West. Without that infrastructure and without that irrigation, not only would the agriculture not exist in the American West, but neither would many of the cities which now depend on it. Los Angeles, Las Vegas, all those great cities of the American West really have been built in virtually desert surroundings. You know, again, there are critics of the way the Bureau worked, because certainly up until the late 60s, early 70s, no concern was expressed for nature conservation or the environments which were being lost when the dams were built. But you still can't deny that it is an absolutely colossal American achievement and an example of the state in action. In fact, curiously enough, it's one of the few examples of state investment, state planning, that Milton Friedman actually grudgingly acknowledges in one of his books as something which is a valuable activity of the state. So again, it kind of gives the lie to Reagan's, in my view, ridiculous remark about when anybody arrives from the government and says they're here to help, things are going to fail, because that is not actually the case. It's patently not the case. It's not the case in case of national parks and dams, but it's not the case either in the case of more basic infrastructure like railroads, the interstates, the moonshot, or planning for New York, for that matter.
Yes, that's true. And, you know, I will go back to the first one you talk about, the shining roads, the building of railroads down here. There's the Florida East Coast Railroad that Flagler built here in up and down in Florida and the Overseas Highway. Can you talk about, the first ones was our infrastructure was just railroads.
Yeah, that's right. It's true that, you know, the railroads effectively built America, and they are still an incredibly important part of America's freight distribution infrastructure. But when I talk to people about American railroads in this country, they always start with a natural assumption that, well, hey, weren't they all built by the robber barons? Weren't they all built by the private sector? Well, yeah, they were. The transcontinental railroads were built by private companies. But what people don't understand is that the private companies, right from the outset, were hugely supported by government. The initial companies building railroads on the East Coast were supported in terms of equity, grants, and all kinds of subsidies by state governments, who were very anxious to see the railroads built. Indeed, if you compare American railroads with very early German railroads in Prussia, you would have expected to find, one would have I expected to find, that the Germans, the Prussians, would have been planning their railroads as a state system. But in fact, the Prussians in the early years didn't get involved at all. They left it to the private sector. It was in the United States that government, through the states, individual states, got involved. When you get to the transcontinental railroads, yeah, they were built by the robber barons, and a fascinating tale it is. But that whole enterprise was underpinned by the state, because the state was providing what are known as land grants. As each successive mile of transcontinental railroad was built, the state granted huge amounts of state land holdings, which of course were widespread in the west of America, partly because of the Louisiana purchase of land from the French government. They granted land grants, very valuable land grants, to the railroads as they moved across America. And as the railroads were built and the land was granted, its value rose because of the existence of the railroads. I discovered when I was writing that chapter that, of course, exactly the same mechanism was used to build the top 50 US technological universities. Government granted land to those universities to give them a permanent endowment of land and income so that they could continue to invest in technology. The most famous of those, of course, is MIT. So government has always been intimately involved in creating the economic bedrock of American society. Again, something which in the 70s, the neoliberals refused to accept. But when you look at the empirical evidence, you look at the facts, you can see that this is the case.
Well, yes, that's true. When I did some research for it on the Flagler Railroad, and it was really the Florida legislature, that was doing the land grants. And there was no economy in Central and South Florida, period. And that's how they started to get any kind of economic activity going.
Yeah, that's very true.
It was the government of state of Florida. Yeah. So another success story. Let's go to, I'll go to another highway that I like, the Overseas Highway that replaced the rail on the road. What about, and this was Eisenhower, the engineering of our interstate highways.
Yeah, exactly. Another example of the state very, very directly involved in building new infrastructure. The need for new American highways was absolutely apparent in the 20s and the 30s because of all the industrial societies, America became the industrial society most dependent on cars and kind of keenest on cars in a way. If you think about it, you know, the the road has an extraordinary role in American popular culture, particularly post-war popular culture. You know, if you read Steinbeck's book, The Grapes of Wrath, it's about people being on the road. If you read that great beat novel by Jack Kerouac, On the Road, it's about people being on the road. If you read that hippie-era classic, Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance, again, it's all about a motorcycle road trip. Being on the road seems to have a kind of central role in American culture and American society. You know, it was the roads that got the American black people from the southern states up to places like Chicago and Detroit in the 40s and the 50s and got them into well-paid jobs. So it's a central component of American life. But prior to state government action, which was really led by Eisenhower, probably a somewhat underrated president, if it hadn't been for Eisenhower's government actually taking the initiative, then the roads would never have been built, because the different interest groups were simply constantly arguing with each other about what the priorities were for building the roads. But, you know, as the American historian, or rather the historian of America, John Brogan, says, probably the interstate highways have done more to shape the lives of American people than any other law passed since 1945, because what they did was they reinforced the ascendancy of the private car over all other forms of transport. They made continental bus services possible, boosted freight by carrying truck, gave a huge impetus to black emigration, and as I was saying, and gave a huge stimulus to the prosperity of the 60s, encouraging car ownership, and thus those vast sprawling suburbs. You know, there was a price to pay in terms of the way in which the roads reshaped American society, but there's no question that the great post-war boom actually was underpinned by that massive state government investment in road building. And if it hadn't happened, there's not much doubt that the post-war boom would not have proceeded in the way it did and at the speed it did. We've now got every great plan produces a success story, but you go further down the line and it produces its problems. We've now got the problems of sprawl and over-intensive use of highways and the ecological crisis caused by carbon dioxide emissions. So those are problems to be solved, but you can't really deny, again, that these were great American plans, and they were implemented very successfully at huge cost and have created a terrific asset.
Yeah, and you know, I was thinking one time I drove from Florida to California on our I-10, and I was, how easy it was for me to do that. And I thought about, you know, I had Starbucks, I had, you know, I rest stops, I've got hotels, and how difficult, you know, the people in the horse and wagon who went over all that terrain. I'm like, how in the world did they do it?
Well, that's, in fact, that was one primary reason for Eisenhower's interest in building the highways, because as a young man in the early 20th century, he'd been involved as a very young army officer in an exercise, in fact, in 1919, when he had joined an American army truck convoy crossing the United States from coast to coast to find out just how good or bad the roads were. And that convoy only managed an average speed between Washington, D.C. and San Francisco of 5 miles per hour. And I'm sure that experience as a young man stuck with him when he became president later.
Ah, so he was like, yeah, this, you got to pick up some speed here.
Yes, exactly. My opportunity to sort these problems out all those years on, yeah.
No rest stops and, you know, anything like that.
Yeah.
That's just...
Yeah.
another one, No Little Plans, Power Brokers, Business Elites, and the Making of New York City.
I'm told by a good friend of mine that this is an exercise in revisionism, because that chapter is essentially about two things. It's about the creation of regional planning in the 20s and the 30s, led by business elites, first in Chicago, the great plans for Chicago, and then the great regional plans for New York, which were created before the war. Those plans set the agenda for the creation of regional parks on a huge scale, but they also set the agenda for road building on an absolutely colossal scale in New York. And it was Robert Moses who was vilified, really, by Jane Jacobs and her friends in the 60s. It was Robert Moses who drove those plans forward in a quite extraordinary way. Moses was probably not the nicest man in the world. He was a tough, arrogant and pretty ruthless bureaucrat, you know, the sort of the ultimate autocratic bureaucrat. But he delivered physical infrastructure for New York on an absolutely colossal scale. He was, as I say, vilified by Jane Jacobs and company in the 1960s. But the real reason for the decline in Moses' stock, despite his colossal achievements, not only in building roads, but also in building bridges and tunnels, was the book written by Anthony Caro in, I think, the 70s, called The Power Broker. It is an absolutely magnificent biography of Moses, but it portrays him really as a man who destroyed New York. And the book was written in the 70s by Caro because at that time, of course, New York did appear to be a city on the way out. And Moses was really an appropriate fall guy for what appeared to be the demise of New York. Well, we know that New York's decline in the 70s was very short-lived, and New York later came roaring back as one of the great capitals of American finance capital, the capital of capital, I suppose you could call it. And subsequently, people have sort of turned around and said, well, maybe Caro wasn't entirely reasonable in the way he criticized Moses. And there's a kind of reinvention going on of Moses' career and achievements as a great city planner and builder. And people were saying, people have been saying in New York, including New York's most recent chief planner, that we need someone like Moses to get big projects moving. And really, I suppose it goes back to my motivation in writing this book. How did we get things going in the past? Because we sure are going to need to get things going in the future, and we're going to have to start reinventing a positive planning style, which maybe we forgot.
Oh, yeah, that's a good point. How to kickstart, you know, good and always get better planning.
That's right. Yeah, and it's actually Amanda Burden, who was New York's city planner in the early 2000s, who said she wanted to. You know, big cities need big projects and are a necessary part of their diversity and competition. So she was an admirer of Jane Jacobs, as indeed are we all. But her view was that we needed to start building again, rather like Moses did. She said, once again, we need to build like Moses on an unprecedented scale, but with Jane Jacobs firmly in mind. What seemed to be a disaster in the late 20th century, people are coming to reevaluate, which is an interesting turnaround.
That's a good point for all of our cities too, turning around.
You need the Jane Jacobs agenda, you need the diversity, you need the sympathy to old buildings, you need the respect for the vernacular, and you need to focus on public transport and walking. Yeah. But at the same time, you do need some big projects as well. So there are lessons, I think, in what was achieved in New York for cities really in America and across the world.
Oh, touche. Okay, I'm going to go to another one. This is a fun one. Apollo 11 and our NASA program, the moon and the computer. Let's shoot off to outer space for a little bit. What's this chapter about?
Well, this is, you know, the moonshot is surely the ultimate American big project. I was around as a schoolboy when the moonshot took place and Americans walked on the moon. I must admit that I must have been a bit of a cynical schoolboy because I thought, well, that seems like an enormously expensive project that doesn't seem to have generated much in terms of returns. It just seemed like a national vanity project. Well, writing this chapter has sent me through 180 degrees because what I didn't realize was that the whole act of getting those men to the moon had provided such a massive stimulus. It was a classic state-led, mission-orientated project. We are going to take people to the moon. That's the mission. We're going to do it. We don't care how much it's going to cost. Yeah, we're going to bring them back again as well, which is fairly important. But what I hadn't appreciated was that kind of mission-led planning would generate enormous benefits for the US economy in terms of developing a style of administration, bureaucracy, and management simply capable of managing such enormous, complicated projects, but also because of the impact which Apollo 11 had on the development of information technologies and computers, which, again, I knew nothing about. And I suspect many people know little about, because the most important part of the lunar module was the Apollo guidance computer, which got that module down onto the surface of the moon and then safely off again. It's probably had as much computing in it as you have in a modern smartphone. But the whole basis for... So it laid the foundations for the information economy, for microcomputers, and most importantly for microchips, which of course are at the heart of smartphones, all the digital equipment that surrounds us these days. The reason the microchips were created was they were created essentially for the Apollo's guidance computer, the AGC, and they were created by the American government agencies simply saying to the manufacturers of those chips, which were very unreliable in the 60s and 70s, look, we want a perfectly reliable chip. How can you create a perfectly reliable chip? And the answer was, you just keep throwing money at the project until we build you hundreds and thousands of chips until they are actually totally reliable, totally reliable technology. So you can see that behind the images of those men on the moon lay this tiny little device inside the lunar module, and an even smaller device within it, the microchip, which has really been the bedrock of America's, and indeed the world's, knowledge economy since then. So again, it's another example of government creating wealth on a colossal scale.
We couldn't even be doing this interview today if it wasn't for that.
That's a very good point. We couldn't be doing it. No, we might be doing it on antiquated telephone technology, but you wouldn't get a very clear signal.
We'd really have a time delay then.
Yeah, we would.
Because for the viewing audience, we're connected via laptop. This isn't we're recording live. We're recording, but that's how we're connecting to do this podcast.
Yeah, that's right. This is live in Liverpool and live in Miami. Yes,
that's right.
Perfect sound quality. We could be sitting next to each other.
That's true. It's amazing. So how about this? We'll go into this as kind of going into it. The frontiers of the mind, how government, who created the internet?
So as I was saying, Wells foresaw the creation of the internet in a speech he gave in 1937. He said, "A world encyclopedia no longer presents itself to a modern imagination as a row of volumes printed and published. This is a sort of mental clearinghouse for the mind, a depot where knowledge and ideas are received, sorted, summarized, digested, clarified, and compared. It would be in continual correspondence with every university, every research institution, every competent discussion, every survey, every statistical bureau. The encyclopedic organization need not be concentrated in one place. It might have the form of a network, It would centralize mentally, but not physically. Well, that is an absolutely astonishing piece of foresight, because Wells was foreseeing the internet before the technology, the digital electronic technology, which was used to create the internet, had even been dreamt of. So it's an amazing act of imaginative foresight. But it was Professor Vannevar Bush who became Roosevelt's and later Truman's key scientific advisor, who also foresaw it in conceptual terms. It was he who helped to bring the thing into reality. So really, just as the moonshot developed America's role in microchips and microcomputers, really it was the internet, which was also underpinned by state investment. The internet was basically invented by the American government through its Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, DARPA, and was bankrolled probably as a means of creating a robust communication network in the event of a nuclear attack, although the scientists involved in the project would deny that. But it was through DARPA, and particularly through one particular individual in DARPA, J.C.R. Licklider, that the whole concept was developed and driven forward. And all of this the technological foundations to the internet, the thinking, the research, was all bankrolled by government. It's true that entrepreneurs have made an awful lot of money out of it. People like Bezos and Microsoft, all those guys have made a great deal of money. But all they're doing really is exploiting wealth, which was created by American state government intervention. So it is really the ultimate example of the way in which American governments have created the economic bedrock of American society. It's an absolutely fascinating tale. So those case studies that we've kind of worked our way through really summarize the core of the book. What I move on to in the final chapter is comparing what the American government is doing now, driven by the neoliberals and their utter distaste for state intervention. They just saw it as utterly wasteful, with what's been happening in Asian countries. Effectively, Asian countries have kind of learned the lessons from the lessons of the importance of effective state planning from America.
And they're progressing forward. So what in the last part, the American dilemma, the road from serfdom. So where do we go from here?
Well, basically, that part of the book looks back on these American success stories, and it starts to look at what is actually happening in Asia. Because if you look at what's happening in Asia, in Korea, in Japan, in Singapore, and of course in China, you don't find neoliberal state capital. You don't find neoliberal raw capitalism there. You find directed capitalism. You find mission-oriented development, where new industries have been created by partnerships, state-led partnerships, state-led companies, sometimes, of course, in China, bringing in international direct investment into those economies. But basically, the success of Asian economies over the last probably 5-6 decades has come about because government has been very actively involved in developing those economies, very actively involved in providing infrastructure. You know, the sharpest contrast there is the state of the American railroad system, which I experienced when I was last in America, when I decided to try the train between New York and Chicago. And my American son-in-law said, "Oh God, don't take the train. Nobody uses the train in America. It's so slow. It's so unreliable. Everybody flies." I said, "I want to take the train because I want to see what it actually looks like." So I did. Well, the train was 16 hours late because of the condition of the infrastructure. You compare that to what's happening in China, where the Chinese over the last 2 or 3 decades have built a brand new high-speed rail system connecting one province of China to another. So there's this amazing irony now that America feels so threatened by the rise of economic power in Asia, but economic power in Asia is being driven by the same planning ideologies and pragmatic techniques that we use to create wealth in America over more than a century, which have now largely been abandoned because of the attack they came under in the late 1960s, early 1970s. It's kind of interesting that the commitment to mission-oriented planning is starting to arise again from politicians, most notably from left-wing politicians like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who's chosen to shape her climate policy, the Green New Deal, in that old American tradition of the New Deal, the moonshot, and making it the civil rights movement of her generation. Because the Green New Deal that she's proposing would be a mission-oriented, state-led planning process, which very closely mirrors all those great plans which I've enumerated and dissected in the central part of the book.
Yes, all the successes, and we were doing it right. We did a lot of things right.
Yeah, you were doing a lot of things right, but you kind of stumbled in the '60s, and you stumbled because of the rise of this ideology developed by Hayek, Friedman, and all the rest of that gang, which was actually based, it wasn't based on evidence, it was based on rhetoric, and nobody's ever seemed to actually go and say, well, hang on a minute, let's go and look at the evidence. How were you doing in the 50s, the 60s, and the 70s, and in previous decades, when the government had a much better, bigger role in the US economy? And indeed, how well were you doing in the Second World War, when the US was the arsenal of democracy in every sense? But if you ask yourself where the money was coming from, where the investment was coming from in order to deliver all that wartime material, which really saved the world from totalitarianism, well, the great majority of it was coming from, not from the private sector, but by government investment coming through Roosevelt's Defense Plant Corporation. So there really is no question that state-led activity, government-led activity in the United States is not anathema to the pursuit of life and liberty and happiness, but has been central to the whole process of wealth creation, and that's essentially what I've the argument which I've made in this book.
Oh well, thank you. That's such a it's enlightening to have an outside, you know, objective look at some really good and positive things that that America's done.
Thank you very much. I wondered whether it was appropriate for an outsider to do that, but probably it is, because you get an outsider's view.
No, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Which is unvarnished, isn't it, and untainted. So somebody who's just basically gone to look at the evidence and drawn conclusions from the evidence.
And it is the evidence, because I've done some research on railroads and et cetera, and so I could vouch for it too. And this is a fabulous book. So I mean, it's all right there. The evidence is right there. So. I hope
it's not just there, but I hope it's written in an engaging way and something that's actually fairly easy to read. I have also tried to lace humour into the book as well. It's kind of quite difficult doing that, lacing humour into an academic book, but it's not impossible. So anybody who reads the book will find it. It's like kind of eating a plum pudding and finding a sixpenny piece in it occasionally. Lightens the reader's load, I hope.
Oh, I think so too. Yeah, the book is really engaging. It's a great book. I think people should read it. Ian, I know we've taken up a lot of your time today, and my cup of tea is about gone. Yeah. So can you tell our audience, what are you working on now?
Well, I've decided to change direction a bit. I'm still extremely interested in cities and creativity in cities. And the next idea on my agenda is to look at the rise of really English pop music between 1960 and 1980. All those wonderful bands, which is those of us who are as old as me will remember very directly, the Beatles, the Rolling Stones, David Bowie, Stevie Winwood, Traffic, the Small Faces, The Who, the list goes on and on. And the question I've posed, and I want to try and answer in this book, is why on earth did it happen? Why did it happen here? What were the mainsprings of all that intense explosion of musical creativity, which started in Liverpool, which is where I happen to live, and then spread across the rest of the UK, and then more or less took over the world in the late 60s and the early 70s. So that's my next book. I haven't got the title yet, but I've written a paper to get things going, which will be appearing next year in a special Creative Cities edition of Built Environment magazine, and it's called The Pool of Life, Liverpool Rock Music and the Roots of Urban Creativity. And that tries to answer the question, why did this amazing explosion of popular music and creativity happen in Liverpool, which is these days my home city, which was, you know, if you think about it, in the late 50s and 60s, was a bomb-damaged, weary, northern British working-class city. Why did it happen here? So that's the question I'm trying to answer, and I think I have answered in this paper, which you'll all have to wait for, apart from you, Tricia, because I'm going to email a copy of it to you as soon as we finish this interview. And then I'm going to try and answer on the bigger scale in the book.
So, that sounds great. That's going to be popular over here in the United States. So, when you finish, you're going to have to send me a copy. You can do that. Thank you so much for being here today. And I'll let the audience know, this is Ian Ray, and his book is No Little Plans: How Government Built America's Wealth and Infrastructure. Published by Routledge in 2019. Government is good, too.
Okay. Thank you very much, Tricia. It was great talking to you.
Again, thank you so much for listening today. And this is, again, Tricia Keffer from sunny Key Largo, Florida, your host for New Books in Architecture, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. If you have any ideas for books, please send me an email at plantspeoplelove@gmail.com. And the book was No Little Plans: How Government Built America's Wealth by Ian Ray, published by Routledge in 2019. Thanks for listening.